on WHYY FM in Philadelphia. At 4:20 today, we'll continue the fifth and final part in our series of lectures by psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Lifton, on the psychological and spiritual impact of the nuclear arms race. Today, he'll summarize some of the subjects he's been discussing over the past 4 days and talk about the need for individual action to prevent nuclear war. With me now on Fresh Air is Esther Rowell, who is currently starring in the Drama Guild production of Carson McCullough's play The Member of the Wedding. She plays Bernice, a housekeeper who is the only confidant of a lonely 12-year-old girl who is despondent because she's never felt like she belonged or was wanted anywhere. In the 1960s, Esther Rowell was one of the original members of the Negro Ensemble Company. In the 70s, she reached national television audiences, first as a regular on the soap opera One Life to Live, then as Florida Evans, the housekeeper on the series Maud. She soon had her own spin-off series, Good Times. Her husband in the sitcom was played by John Amos. Her son was played by Jimmy Walker, whose signature expression on the show was dynamite. Rowell left the series for 1 year in protest over how this black family was depicted. She was especially displeased at how the role of J.J., the son, had developed into a scheming, lazy clown. Rowell has also starred in the television adaptation of Maya Angelou's memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and she won an Emmy for her performance of The Summer of My German Soldier. The Drama Guild production of The Member of the Wedding will be performed through December 11th at the Zellerbach Theater at the Annenberg Center in West Philadelphia at 37th and Walnut Streets. For more information, you can call 546-0776. That's 546-0776. Esther Rowell, welcome to Fresh Air, and I really enjoyed your performance in the play.
Thank you very much, Terry.
I'd like to start by talking a little bit about television, since I know so many of our listeners will know your performances from TV. How were you first offered the role on the series Maud as Florida Evans?
Well, I was doing a play on Broadway. I was doing Melvin Van Peebles' Don't Play Us Cheap. Jane Murray, who is the casting agent for Tandem Productions, saw the show, wired him, hold off, I found Florida. And I went out there.
Did you think twice about taking the role as a black housekeeper? Because, I'm thinking in a way that the Negro Ensemble Company was developed as a place to get roles where you wouldn't have to play housekeeper type roles, which was for many years some of the only roles for black women in movies or television or the stage. So how did that strike you when the offer was made?
Well, very poorly when they first told me about it. But then I asked, because I didn't particularly want to go to Hollywood, and they finally called and said, what is the holdup? Why don't you want to do it? I said, I was not interested in playing a Hollywood maid. They wanted to know what that meant. And I said, you know, the inhuman, detached, laughing, clowning, fat black lady that I know no human being who's like it. And when Norman assured me that that was not what he was looking for and described Maud as an over-liberal, upper-middle-class white woman and Florida as a woman of the same strength, he said what he was looking for was the two sides of the same coin. And I asked, well, will I have anything to say about the dialect and about the dialogue? And he said, sure, you can. I said, oh, well, then I'll be right there. I particularly wanted to have a chance to nationally portray the role of a housekeeper or a maid or whatever you would call it, because I sorely resented the way they had been depicted. And I felt that I would have a chance to redeem some of those ill-conceived notions of what a black maid was like.
Did Norman Lear's willingness to have you change the dialect when necessary or alter the dialogue prove to be true once you actually started working on the series?
Oh, sure. I think that's one of his great successes. He listens.
Then you had your own spin-off series,
mm-hmm.
Good Times,
mm-hmm.
which the characterizations on that changed in the years that you played it, and you ended up leaving for a year in protest. How did the characters change to the point that you wanted to walk out?
Well, in the first place, when the series was conceived, it was for me and my three children. Having come from a home where there was a mother and a father, and my father having lived with us all of our lives, I never wanted to take a role where there was no father in the home for a series, something that would go on that long. Because I couldn't understand why people felt afraid to show a black father in a home. That was our first contention. So they finally gave me a husband. I felt that there were many actresses who could play the role. And I didn't feel that I could play it without a father. I felt it would be a betrayal of my own father and of all the other fathers that I knew as I grew up. The children I grew up with had fathers. Yet television or movies in this country had never seen fit to give a father in the home. It was always a mother and her children with the father gone. And that's a very one-sided portrayal of an entire group of people. So I felt that I couldn't add to that. But when they gave me the husband, and I had something to do with the selection of that husband, because I said he'll have to be a particular kind of a person. I really based it sort of on the image of my father. John Amos said, I understand exactly what you want. I'd love to do it. And he proved to be just what I wanted in the father. We worked beautifully together. Of the children, it was mainly the daughter and the younger son who were aspiring to do things. And the older boy was sort of a ne'er-do-well, you know, just gadabout. And he had really the lesser role. And before long, the little one who was aspiring to be one day sit on the Supreme Court bench, the daughter who wanted to be this great dancer, were minimized, and the clownishness of the older boy maximized to the point it became a clown show, and I didn't feel that it was necessary for me to be a part of that. I felt there were other things that I could do in life that would be more meaningful. We had a program that was funny and had pathos. It had everything. Why change it to a clown show? Ours was unique.
Did you give an ultimatum or did you just leave?
I didn't give an ultimatum. I asked over and over about changes, about not overplaying this and playing up something of importance more so. You see, it was not a real-life situation. In a black family of that stature, a boy, a 19-year-old boy, would long since have had a job and been helping out in the family. My brothers were delivering newspapers or mowing lawns or delivering grocery at the grocery store, doing something from the time they were like 9, 10. In a black family, a 19-year-old does not sit on his behind doing nothing, while parents struggle, the father on two jobs, the mother taking care of the home and a part-time job. It was totally unbelievable. And then all the clowning around that he was doing. And it became a kind of a source of embarrassment to me.
Why did you go back after taking a year off?
Because I was asked by the head of CBS. Mr. Paley called me. I told him my problems with it, and he said what concessions he could make.
Were you pleased with those concessions?
Yes and no. I had taken it off my heart. I had divorced myself from it. I went back because it would have meant a lot of people out of work. I went back for the year, but I told him I would only go back for 1 year. The show lost its ratings after I left completely. And he had said he was going to close the show. So I went back for the year that I promised to go back. But the joy of doing Good Times, I had lost.
Esther Rolle is my guest, and she's now starring in the Drama Guild production of The Member of the Wedding in Philadelphia. You've had a pre-television and post-television theater career. How has your visibility on TV affected the roles that you get now and the kind of people who come out and see you when you're in a production?
Well, it hasn't affected the type of roles I get. I'm still a black woman in these United States. And a black woman over 45. So the pickings are very slim. I still do the things that I feel I could live with. But it hasn't been plentiful. Nothing has really happened. I have not gotten great offers to do things. The show that I won the Emmy for. Dear Little Christie had shows lined up waiting for her. Nobody even knew I existed. But that's the way it is in this business here in this country. And until we get more good stories written about mature black women, they'll always be maids, madams of some house of prostitution, all kinds of, that I'm not interested in. But I love community theater. I love little theater. And as long as I can sort of keep my head above water, I don't grieve about it because the material that's out there is not worth grieving about.
Sometimes I think that the situation on television has gotten worse as far as serials and sitcoms that are about black families.
Yes.
Or about a black person in a white family, which is what most of the shows with black stars in them are like now.
Yes, yes.
It's like a black maid in a white family or a black kid is adopted into a white family. Is it really can you explain that phenomenon?
I wish I could.
Yeah, because I've had trouble trying to make sense of it.
I suppose you'll have to get into the heads of the creators of these things to find out what all that is about. It's very unnatural. And therefore, sometimes it taxes the mind to try to sit through and watch to see what is behind it, what's going on. Interesting shows, but interesting again, the conception. Very interesting.
Are there series that you think are exemplary now on TV, or at least good?
Well, I've always liked Benson. I think they're kind of funny. And yet, there are a couple of people on that show that I find quite good and worth watching. I was very pleased with Fame. That went by the boards. There isn't too much that is very pleasing to me. Perhaps I'm a bit critical, but I don't think so. I think some of these things just, you just don't see how they could be.
What do you think of the role of Bernice that you play in Member of the Wedding? It's funny because it's another play in which the role for the black woman is the role of a maid, it's you know, a far more sensitively written play than the kind of you know, black maid type roles that you see now on television.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I don't see Bernice as the maid. She is the surrogate mother.
Yes, right.
In that home.
Mm-hmm.
And as a woman, I like children. I think they should be heard. And this is a lonely child whose father is insensitive to her emotional needs. He has retired from the world, it seems, after the death of his wife, who died in childbirth having this child. He has done all the things that he thinks he should have done, his requirements. I provide a home. I provided food. I buy her clothing. I provided a female to take care of her. I'm through. And that's as far as his fatherly being in the home goes. And Bernice is mother to that child and to the boy next door, although he has mother and father. He's never there because they, too, are detached from the child. They didn't even know when he got sick. And I think there is a bit of a childlike quality in adults who would raise children properly. You've got to reflect on your feelings and thoughts at that age and then see the child's problem through that reflection.
That's an interesting point. You know, you had 18, or you were one of 18 children in your family. So does that give you like 18 different possibilities to think about when you're thinking about like children in your family, the children who you grew up with?
Not necessarily. I think the kind of guidance that I had from my parents gives me an insight to children. My mother saw into children, and she lived with her children at whatever age they were, and helped them solve their problem, not through her mature eyesight, but through theirs. When they came in and said, I was attacked by a dog the size of a horse and hollering, she talked to you, my goodness, that's terrible, and she'll find out. And little by little, she'll get you around to describing this dog. And you'll find out it was a puppy. And she said, let me see where he bit you. And you find out that there is no scar. And she said, you know, maybe he was a little dog and maybe he was just playing with you. And soon the fright leaves. And you begin to say, oh, you know, my dog really didn't bite me. But she saw it through your eyes. And she saw the bigness that a child looks up and sees when he sees a grown-up. She had a way with her of when she was busy, which she always was, doing something in the kitchen, the baby is on the floor fretting. And she never stopped her work, but she would just stop, pick the baby up and put him on the table or in a high chair where he could see what's going on. And the noise stopped immediately. And I remember somebody asking her one day, you didn't do anything. Why did you stop crying? She says, you forget. There's nothing down there but feet and maybe ankles and possibly legs. He doesn't see what's going on. If he could see, he would be interested in the activities. And put the baby up here so he could see something. He doesn't see anything. Nothing is happening down there. I thought that was very intuitive of her, because that had never occurred to me that the baby can't see anything. All the wonderful things you see around the house, a bright Play-Doh, a flower, or running water. He hears the running water, but he doesn't see it. And her solution was, I don't have time to sit here and hold you, but if you come up here, you can watch what I'm doing. And the watching was the interest. I think that is what more or less I find I'm able to share with children and understand them through her insight into children's feelings.
In The Member of the Wedding, you're dealing with children in two senses. One, as, you know, like in your stage role, but also as an adult who is really excellent in your field and outstanding in it. And then you're working with someone who's, well, not one person who's not that young. I don't know how old she really is, but the young boy, the mm-hmm. boy who plays John Henry, is in fact very young. He looked to me like 12 at most, maybe 10 or 9.
Oh, I think he's 9.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. that's really young. What is there anything that you had to do as an actress with this very young actor? And he was really excellent in the production.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Not particularly. I think he will go far. He listens, he observes. And it's easy to work with him. And if you say, don't. Oh, hey, I'm telling a story, pay attention. He becomes wrapped in it, and that's it.
Can you talk to a 9-year-old about the kinds of cues you want to give each other or the responsiveness that you're getting or not on stage, the way you'd talk to someone who's your peer?
Well, I think you would just do it in a different way, but you can do it. It's easily done. It's knowing, it's having a sensitivity toward another actor. He's not just a little child. He's an actor. And no actor should tell another actor what to do. You might say, you know, I'm having a little difficulty in getting this line across because it takes you longer. Now, if you can tell me why it takes you longer to answer this, then I'll try and adjust. What I'm really saying is pick up your cue. But I can't say that. I don't know. Maybe he has a reason. Maybe he's playing an inner feeling that makes him wait. And then you find out he doesn't have one. And he's, oh, all right. I'll say it quicker. And it's over.
Had you ever seen Ethel Waters in the Bernice role?
I saw it when I first finished high school. I don't remember the play. I remembered incidents. I remembered Frankie's crying. I didn't remember why. And I remember her on Ethel's lap. But there was very little else about the play I remembered. If I had, I might not have been here right now.
Do you not like to perform in things where your memory of someone else's performance in it is still vivid?
No, that's not it. It's that I didn't know I had so many lines to learn. And then I remembered all of that. I don't know if I would have taken it on. It whipped me, but good.
What kind of devices have you developed for learning lines in volume when you need
pray.
To? is that effective?
Now, what I really do is mostly is read over and over and over and over again. And when you finally understand, you realize that it has sunk into your memory for the most part.
Do you still have nightmares about forgetting your lines on stage?
Sure. It can happen at any time. All you have to do is have one little incident happen or a stray thought come into your head while you're working. And by the time you say, get out of here, you don't have any business here, what was I supposed to say? And that's panic time. It's also fun time, seeing how you're going to get back into what you're doing without dropping the show.
Are there times you've had to do that and have come up with something
sure.
particularly creative to get out of it?
I have learned, I get stumbling blocks with words. And it need not be a big word. Just a word. Perfectly was one of my words. One of them is going out of my head again. Every night I have to think about that word. Confusion is another. Night before last, Jane and I had been talking about it, and I said, I don't know why I can't get these. I make little stumbling blocks for myself, and I can't get over them. I said, why can't I say confusion? But I have learned, I've always done this, find another word of the same meaning, and when the word that the author wrote does not come, I have another word for it. But it bugs me that I can't remember that one word. We talked about it night before last for a long time. And last night, I got up there, and when I hear myself coming to that point, I said, oh, Christ, here it comes, here it comes. And it came into my head, and I said, confusion. And I looked at her. A bit of a smile played across both of our faces because it was, ha, I did it, I got it. But you have blocks like that, I do, with one word that I just, it'll be the bane of my life till I finish this show. Every night wondering if I'm going to remember the word.
One of your sisters...
Shouldn't have said that over the air. Now everybody would be listening.
tell us what scene and act it's in. No, just kidding. One of your sisters was an actress, and she was in To Kill a Mockingbird. I don't know if she was an older sister or younger sister, but was she a model for you before you started acting professionally yourself?
Not really. She's my oldest sister. And she's still an actress. She's still working. I have three sisters who are actresses. They had a group, a family group when I'm the 10th. So I'm way down the line. And to entertain the younger children, they used to write little skits and perform them at home. And then cousins, they invited Mama and Papa to come in and see them in the living room. And then cousins and uncles and aunts started coming, and the next thing you know, they were performing in the church. And the church got enthusiastic about it, and they became a group who performed up and down the east coast of Florida, the lower east coast of Florida, as the family circle. You had to be 12. By the time I got to be 12, the older ones were getting married and going away. The group broke up just before Rosanna was the last person to be a member of the family circle. Rosanna works all the time. Rosanna Carter is her name. I think she's doing something right now in North Carolina. I talked with her Sunday. Something called Tales of the Deep South, a series called Tales of the Deep South, and she's doing its final episode. Incidentally, my older sister worked on one episode of it also. But it has always, I suppose, been a part of us. I think Mom and Papa were both very funny people and talented people, I think. And I think if my father had been born not a black man in these United States, he would have been either a lawyer, a minister, or an actor. Because in a strange way, they're all about the same profession. And he was quite a dramatic person. I mean, he was a big man, 6'3". And he would do things like, rather than say, turn the lights out at bedtime, we always carried junk to bed, to eat in bed, under the covers so nobody hear you crunching it. My mother had a thing about eating in bed. She couldn't see how you could sleep in a bed with crumbs in it. Never bothered me. But it really upset her. So you had to sneak all this junk in, and when they say time to turn on the lights, you're supposed to turn the lights out and go to sleep. But that's when it became funny. And I remember my father coming one day to the door, opening the door, and said, "Children, get Edison's hand out of my pocketbook." This is a dramatic way of saying turn out the lights. Why couldn't you just say turn out the lights? And we would just let Edison's pocket. What is he talking about? But they like to tell stories, and we enjoyed them. And I believe they both could have had great talents.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. It's really been a great pleasure to meet you.
Oh, Lord, we didn't get through half of the stuff we were supposed to be talking. Well, that's what happened when you started letting me run my mouth.
Well, I really enjoyed meeting you and enjoyed your performance very much in the play. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Terry.
Esther Rolle has been my guest, and if you'd like to see her perform, she's in the Drama Guild production of The Member of the Wedding, Carson McCullough's play, and it will be performed through December 11th at the Zellerbach Theater at the Annenberg Center, which is at 37th and Walnut Streets in West Philadelphia. For more information, you can call 546-0776. That's 546-0776. It's 23 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up, we're going to conclude our series of lectures with Robert J. Lifton. The United States is currently deploying cruise and Pershing missiles in Western Europe. The Soviet Union has walked out of the Geneva talks in protest. We're in a period where it seems people around the world are increasingly concerned about the possibility of nuclear war. Throughout this week on Fresh Air, we've been featuring a series of lectures on the spiritual and psychological effects of the nuclear arms race, written and presented by Robert J. Lifton. Lifton is a Yale research psychiatrist who's been studying the impact of the arms race since his 1962 trip to Hiroshima, where he interviewed atom bomb survivors. These lectures were originally produced for the Canadian Broadcasting Company's 1982 Massey Lecture Series. WHYY Radio has received special permission from the CBC to rebroadcast these lectures at this time. There are no transcripts of these lectures available through the CBC or WHYY Radio. Again, we cannot offer transcripts of these broadcasts. However, an expanded version of Lifton